Alberta and the Prairie provinces have been hammered like everyone else by the shutdown of their economy by the coronavirus. It is another blow to an already beleaguered region. Oil and gas revenues tanked over the past few years when the price of a barrel of oil plunged. Add in a chorus of voices both domestically and internationally calling for the demise of the Canadian energy sector, and the current federal government's mixed messages about the development of resources in Alberta in particular. The combination of hits fueled feelings of alienation and growing support for separation. Premier Jason Kenney, in reading the mood of Albertans, commissioned the Fair Deal panel in an attempt to get feedback on ideas that would provide Alberta with greater control of its destiny. Then, in the midst of the pandemic that is infecting the entire country, Green Party outgoing leader Elizabeth May warned the Prime Minister to not put money into supporting the oil and gas sector because, as she put it, oil is dead. All indications are that Ms. May is wrong. The Energy Information Administration says the demand for oil will remain strong for decades to come. Her comments and those of the Bloc Québécois leader are one of the many elements fueling a growing interest among Albertans to leave Canada. We invited Mark Milkey to join us for a conversation that matters about Alberta and the Western Province's contributions to Canada and how to find a path back to a calmer relationship. This is the first in a series of interviews focusing on alienation and a push towards separation by Alberta that will be published on the Conversations That Matter YouTube channel.
Conversations That Matter is a partner program of the Center for Dialogue at Simon Fraser University. The production of this program is made possible thanks to the following and viewers like you. Please become a patron at conversationsthatmatter.tv.
Mark, thanks for joining me.
You bet.
The West has made a considerable contribution to Canada ever since Confederation, even though it wasn't a part of the country in 1867. When we look at the overall contribution to Canada, how do we quantify that? And then let's start to be more specific as we get into the last 50 or 60 years.
You can classify it to start with as huge. So between 1961 and recently, Alberta alone, for example, gave over $600 billion to the federal treasury. So it's $15,000 per year annually for a family of four. That compares to Ontario, around $5,000, British Columbians, a family of four, $2,000 annually since 1961. So these are some terrific numbers that the University of Calgary Public Policy School came up with. And what they illustrate is just how important the West has been to federal coffers over the decades. And that also is part of the reason why Westerners, and Albertans in particular, and I've been back and forth between British Columbia and Alberta my entire life, but why Westerners who are aware of these sorts of numbers can get a little agitated in good times or in bad times both with some ways the West is treated some days.
When we look at the equalization, transfer payment process, has Alberta ever been a recipient or has it always been a contributor?
I think you have to go back to the 1930s to actually be a recipient. But the modern equalization program, if you look at it over the last couple of decades, it's really inefficiently designed, to put it mildly. I've written a number of studies on this topic. So I can tell you that there are a number of flaws, I would say, in it. It actually encourages provinces not to develop their economies. So, for example, Quebec has oil and gas. It doesn't really develop its oil and gas. Part of a local opposition in some cases, or just a preference, I guess, by the political class. The problem with that is parts of the country like Alberta or Saskatchewan that do develop their natural resources, and especially during boom times when they receive great royalties, tax revenues, and the rest of it, all of a sudden, part of the federal taxes that flow from the West into federal coffers then end up in provincial coffers in Quebec. And this is in a province that has forswore most resource development, or at least oil and gas. That becomes particularly irritating to a province like Alberta when times are tough and Quebec is running a surplus. I mean, all of us are going to have to put aside the current pandemic, the current issues around that, the current numbers. But in a normal year, so to speak, let's go back to 2019, Quebec had a surplus in its provincial budget. I think it was about $4 billion. But the only reason it had that surplus is because of $13 billion in equalization payments, which by and large originate in the have provinces of Ontario, British Columbia, Alberta. And so the notion that Quebec is kind of a constant taker in Confederation and not a giver is extremely irritating to Westerners who know their numbers. I'll tell you a story. I once met former Bloc Québécois leader Gilles Doucet. We had a meeting at the Calgary Herald on the editorial board that I was on at the time. And Gilles Doucet said to all of us, "You know, Quebec and Alberta have a lot in common." And I said, "Really, Mr. Doucet, what is that?" And he said, "Well, they both give a lot to Ottawa." And I said, "Well, no one I know who knows the numbers thinks that. In fact, quite the opposite. Alberta's given a lot, Quebec has not." And so, but Mr. Doucet said, "Well, no, my aides will get you those numbers." This was about 15 years ago. I'm still waiting for the numbers.
They haven't arrived.
No, because they can't. I mean, the numbers are clear. But this becomes really problematic when you incent provinces like Quebec or the Atlantic provinces or any part of the country, really, depending on its circumstances, not to develop its economy. This is an artificial equation that, with due respect, you know, the federal government, successive federal governments came up with. And it doesn't help. And in fact, in times like this, it's even worse because you have provinces like Quebec and parts of Atlantic Canada importing oil, of course, from various parts of the world. You also have central Canada importing natural gas from places like Pennsylvania or North Dakota. There are sometimes local reasons for that in terms of transportation networks. But it speaks to the absurdity, though, of provinces not developing natural resources in a cold northern country where other provinces could develop these natural resources and don't, and yet they take money from through the federal transfer payment system, basically from the pockets of British Columbians, Albertans, and to a degree also Ontarians. This is hugely problematic. It particularly irritates Westerners, I think, in down times like these.
When you add in the fact that the government of Quebec also blocks the shipping of Alberta oil by pipeline through its territory to eastern Canada, in essence, Quebec is saying, "We don't want you to sell your product if it passes through our province, but we'll happily take your money."
Some people would call it virtue signaling, but there's nothing virtuous about taking money from, you know, other parts of the country through federal taxes and then dismissing really the resources from where a lot of that wealth has come from historically over the last five decades. So when a Quebec City mayor, for example, dismisses Western oil as dirty, when a Quebec premier issues similar language, when you have mayors of Burnaby or Victoria in British Columbia, in a resource province that I grew up in, dismiss really resource products from the prairies, Alberta, Saskatchewan. This is not helpful to a healthy confederation. And of course, it's, how should one put this? It's slightly disingenuous to live off the proceeds of others if you're in Quebec, or, you know, if you're in British Columbia, to disparage a resource economy that frankly you're still part of and should be part of. I mean, I'm from southern British Columbia, but I've tree planted northern British Columbia. I remember Fort Nelson. I remember Prince George. And those cities now are doing better because of resources like natural gas, and well, they should. And there are points on the coast of British Columbia that could do much better. My friend Ellis Ross, who used to be a First Nations, you know, elected counselor for the Hives of First Nation, of course, is famously a proponent of resource development, including natural gas on the coast of British Columbia. Why? Because not all of us can work in Starbucks or want to work in the provincial government of Victoria, lovely as the city is. Not all of us can or should do that. So resource development is important to this country, especially oil and gas.
You mentioned Ellis Ross. He's an important First Nations leader, one who represents in part the important role First Nations will play in the development of resources in all of Canada. And I see that Premier Kennedy understands the importance of those relationships. So how important will those relationships be as Alberta strives to establish a perceived and moral authority, not just in its own province, but throughout the country? when you can say we are working in partnership with First Nations, will that bolster the message that the resources of Alberta provide a tremendous benefit to all Canadians?
Well, I think so, because if you look at the data, you'll find that most First Nations reserves, or a good majority of them, are in rural areas, away from much economic development, much higher education, right? And you really can't, in most cases, bring the mountain to Muhammad, as the cliche goes. But in the case of resource development, whether it's oil, whether it's natural gas, whether it's forestry, whether it's mining, you do have some First Nations reserves which are located near existing and potential economic development in terms of those resources I just mentioned. Now, we know, so for example, around the oil sands, we know the Fort McKay First Nation has some of the highest median incomes in the country. And in fact, they outrank median incomes in 9 of 10 provinces. Their poverty rates are lower, their dependency rates are lower than most provinces in Confederation. Well, why is that? Because they've been involved in the oil sands since the 1980s. So when you see activists, not all, you know, but some activists that are opposed to oil and gas, claim to be on the side of First Nations in this country, I think they are not aware of the facts, or they're not distributing the facts that actually exist, where frankly the First Nations that are involved in resource development, whether it's mining, forestry, oil and gas, that is in many cases their only ticket to a better future if you live in rural Canada.
I found it interesting that J.P. Gladue left his role as the president and CEO of the Canadian Council for Aboriginal Business, a position that placed him in the heart of corporate Canadian influence in Toronto, to take on the role of CEO of Boucher, based in Fort McMurray. It is one of the largest Indigenous-owned contracting firms in the Athabasca oil sands region. And so, why did he move to the Northwest? Well, as he told me in a recent interview, it was an exceptional opportunity. He is not turning his back on the energy sector, and in doing so, he is signaling the importance of the industry in the near and long-term future for First Nations.
Well, I think so, but oil and gas, I mean, is beneficial for First Nations. It's beneficial for other Canadians. I mean, here's an example of why it matters and why it should matter to the rest of the country. Because, again, as I mentioned, I'm originally from southern British Columbia. I wouldn't know anything about oil and gas unless I happen to have lived in Alberta for the last 18 years at this point in my latest stay in this particular province. But years ago, I met a now-deceased gentleman by the name of Jim Talker. Jim grew up not wealthy. His first job, as I recall, no, his father's job. He grew up in the wilds of British Columbia before there was a highway across, before the Rogers Pass existed. And his father worked as a park warden in Yale National Park. So, but I met Jim several years before he died. Jim was an engineer. He is, if I recall correctly, worked for Shell for several years in the 1950s, some other companies. He eventually founded several small energy boutique firms of his own. His last one before he passed away was Petrobank. And when I met him, he was retired at this point, but was still on the board. But I remember Jim telling me over lunch one time, it occurred to him what he meant or what he was most proud of one Christmas when he was still head of Petrobank. He said he looked around the room at a Christmas party and he saw 100 people, and those were his employees. And he realized that his efforts to found this company, and I think it was his third at this point, that his efforts allowed these people to pay their mortgage, to fund higher education for their kids when they grew up. And it was tremendously important to him. Well, multiply that by several hundred thousand people in this country. If you don't have oil and gas in this country, there are several hundred thousand people and their families who will not be getting a paycheck, who will not be able to finance higher education for their kids, who will not be able to buy Christmas presents for their kids. So this is tremendously important, and it's perhaps more important than ever now in this downturn, because the rest of the world, after we recover from this downturn, I can tell you, I know the numbers, demand will come back for oil. it will come back for natural gas. And there are countries that will speed ahead and provide that product for the rest of the world. And most of them are not friendly to Western liberal democratic norms.
Yes.
They include Russia. They include Saudi Arabia. They include Qatar. They include China, which is increasingly producing more natural gas. Now, I wish all countries well, but it is slightly unfortunate, to say the least, that there were some people in this country that oppose oil and gas development reflexively and ideologically, and they will hurt First Nations more. They will hurt other Canadians. They will hurt the kind of people that my friend, the late Jim Talker, talked about when he looked around a Christmas party and saw 100 people who were able to pay a mortgage and provide for their kids because of what this great country offered him and others. Mm-hmm. So I really hope that other people across this country understand that Western alienation is pretty closely tied to the constant opposition by a minority of activists and a minority of politicians who are not taking the broad national interest of this country into account.
Well, doing my research for our interview, I read an interesting article that said the downturn in the economy of Alberta was the result of a one-dimensional economy. It suggested Alberta only has itself to blame for not diversifying.
Yeah.
Okay, Mark, but you know this is a relatively widely held view, one that acknowledges there have been attempts to diversify the economy in the past, but then those attempts are abandoned in boom times in the oil patch. What do you say to that?
It's a bit like King Canute, the famous king who a millennia ago gave a demonstration to his subjects that he was not infallible, that he was not omnipotent. He couldn't command the waves to move back from the shore. He was trying to teach his subjects a lesson, that there are some physical forces in the world you cannot, as a human being, command. And you cannot command diversification in an economy as if you were ordering up a meal at White Spot. And so the Council of Canadians and others who think that Alberta could somehow diversify away from oil and gas need a lesson in basic economics. If you're in Ontario, why would you diversify away from manufacturing? You've got a massive population base in the Northeast. You wouldn't try and produce, I don't know, chopsticks for China if you're living in southern Ontario. You produce manufacturing for the Northeast United States if you can. If you're in northern Alberta, you're not going to try and, say, invent or create new computers or create a Silicon Valley in northern Alberta, because most Silicon Valley types are not going to move to northern Alberta, and they're quite happy where they are. You sell what you have, you develop what you have, and you're not even going to try and set up a massive manufacturing facility in northern Alberta, which is far away from a population base. Likewise, I'm very sympathetic to refineries in British Columbia. It doesn't make sense to have them in Alberta, because again, you're far away from the markets and you're far away from the coastline where a refinery can refine oil and send it in a tanker somewhere else, or send it down a pipeline to, again, markets in the Western United States. It's like asking Hawaii to diversify away from tourism in favor of manufacturing. It would be crazy, and you couldn't do it. And Alberta has been steadily diversifying over the decades, bit by bit, but it's not an overnight thing, and it can't be commanded by governments, and it certainly cannot be commanded by economically illiterate spokespersons.
How do we heal this rift? Is there a formula that can alleviate this alienation?
Well, I think the first thing is to push back against the minority of voices that are anti-resource development, anti-oil and gas development, and therefore, frankly, whether they know it or not, are anti-First Nations in the West and anti-West in general. So I think the first item of business is to isolate those voices, because they're not helpful, and point out that those voices are in fact destructive of a national fabric, which needs all sorts of parts of the economy, right? You need manufacturing, you need oil and gas, you need high tech, you need renewables, you need all of that. So I think the first item of business is to just tell the truth about those who don't seem to understand you need a diversity of economic levers across this country. And none of them can be, frankly, created or invented by governments. I think the second big item is, for those who really care about Canada, in other parts of the country to speak up for Alberta, for Saskatchewan, for Northern British Columbia, for First Nations out here that are taking a big hit right now, not just from the coronavirus, but are taking a hit from anti-oil and gas activism that's been around for the last 15 years. Part of it's funded by foreigners, part of it's funded by domestic interests and domestic people, sometimes sincerely but mistakenly so. And I think just to push back and to, I think other parts of the country, other leaders in other parts of the country need to speak up and say, listen, this cannot continue. This is an important resource to be developed in Western Canada. And so I think if other people in other parts of the country that understand that the West has been, buffeted unfairly so, unnaturally so, by domestic and foreign activists, and by an ideology that says we can get off oil and gas tomorrow, I think it would be helpful for other parts of the country. Otherwise, one has to be careful. I mean, I'm from British Columbia originally, but I've never seen Albertans so upset and frankly so discouraged, because they know they've given a lot to the rest of the country. And there's proof of that on the numbers, as have British Columbians, as has Ontario. Those have been traditionally the three had provinces. I can tell you that it's going to get pretty desperate here in the next little while in Alberta. And I sincerely hope that, that other parts of the country understand that it's really through no fault of Albertans. It is a result of some anti-oil and gas activism. It's a result of Saudi Arabia that has dropped the oil price to almost nothing for the third time in just over three decades, 1986, 2014, 2020. Oil, I wish, was a free market product, but there's an undue amount of control over oil by OPEC and by authoritarian or autocratic or tyrannical nations, Russia, Saudi Arabia, and others. So it's a real problem for Western Canada at this point.
Well, this is a very important discussion that will continue to unfold.